Good evening, everyone, and welcome to another EG Question Time. I'm Damien Wild, editor of EG. It's great to see you all here. And so since our last Question Time here in Manchester 12 months ago, the world feels like it's taken a further uncertain turn or two. Yet commercial real estate continues to surprise on the upside, which is a very good thing, and it's certainly the case here. I don't know if you saw this week, the city is again ranked among Europe's 10 most influential, poised to thrive in the digital age, says that report. And the council's commitment to placemaking as well, we've written about, showing it's possible to attract investment and regenerate older sites. And there's few better examples than here. And young professionals, including one of EG's own reporters, I'm pleased to say, are flocking to the city, and I'm sure most of you have met Carl. And take-up is high, with little prime space on offer as well. But what of the rest of the office market? Is it as rosy? What does a depressed retail offer nationally mean for the city's retail sector? And can demand for the rental revolution meet the considerable supply that's coming through? Answers to these questions are often based on instinct or anecdote in property, but it's changing because real estate is moving in a digital direction. I think anyone who was at our awards last week will have seen that in some of the winners who came through there. And I'm pleased to say that EG is a driving force here. Over the last 6 months, we've launched Radius Data Exchange, the data sharing platform that's created by the market for the market. And I know many of you are subscribing. More and more firms of all shapes and sizes are coming on board, and everyone's welcome, so do talk to a colleague afterwards if your appetite is whetted. So I suspect all of you have been to one of these events or similar before, so I don't need to explain how it's going to work, but do raise your hand if you want to ask a question, and I'll come to you as soon as I can, and a microphone will find you, say who you are and where you're from as well. But much more efficient than that, and greatly increasing your chances of getting your questions answered, and anonymous as well, if you want it to be, is if you get your phones out and go to slido.com, and you can put in questions in the app there, and details will come up on the screen. If you use the hashtag EGQT, you can get into that and put your questions to the panel, and you can also like questions at the top. So if someone else has a better question than you, do that. And as well as asking questions, feel free to disagree with anything that they say or that I say. Feel free to disagree with each other. That will make it more entertaining as well. Right, I should introduce our panel. Closest to me is Rick de Blaby, Executive Deputy Chairman of Get Living. Next to him is James Evans, Head of Office Agency and Head of the Office here in Manchester for Savills. John Mew is Chief Operating Officer for ABP London Royal Albert Docks. Wayne Nash is a partner, a real estate partner at Shoesmiths. Adam White is Director of Commercial and Business Development at Mag Property. And Rachel Wood is Managing Director of Sladen Estates. So I'll kick off as those questions fly in. I'm sure they're going to fly in. There are some in the system already, but I know I can count on you for more to come. And I'll start with you, Rick, as you've made the mistake of sitting closest to me, and put a first question to you that came in earlier that I think will probably pop up on screen, but I'll go ahead. How can Manchester maintain its unique status in a market that is becoming more and more demanding? So you're looking at sites around the country. I suppose the first question is, does Manchester have a unique status, and then how does it maintain it?
Well, look, every city is projecting its own proposition to investors, to occupiers, even to central government. And I would say Manchester's probably been one of the most successful in that, for sure. I do go to lots of other cities, and they're all trying to compete for capital from government. They're trying to compete for capital from investors, and they're obviously trying to draw businesses in to create jobs. And I'd say Manchester has really probably the one that most cities outside London look to as the exemplar, the one that they want to copy. How does it maintain its unique status? I mean, I'd say you've got quite a big lead already. How do you maintain the lead? The infrastructure piece is a big part of it. And if the population of the city centre is growing, then I'm not sure it's so much about the transport infrastructure, but the civic infrastructure has to follow in terms of the doctor's surgeries and the schools and the hospitals and the rest of it. So I guess how would it maintain its status? I'd say it's probably got to look at some of that, given as well the sheer number of new employees that are moving into the city on a whole host of tech and other type businesses that are coming in. I think that would be where I would sit with it.
And when you talk to other cities and you say they use Manchester as their model, are they catching up? Could they overtake? Birmingham's having a good run.
Some are doing pretty well. I mean, we've got something in Glasgow, and I'd say Glasgow's in a good place. They're certainly getting a lot of new employment. Their housing delivery is not anything like it is here in Manchester. I'd say Leeds is doing a whole lot better than it was, let's say, 10 years ago, when I can remember being in Leeds doing quite a big scheme, and they were always looking over the Pennines and trying to kind of mimic Manchester. I think they've found a place where they're a bit more comfortable in their own skin, doing their own thing, and they're succeeding at that. Birmingham as well, I'd say, is very strong on its proposition, and it's capturing a lot of investment and government money. I mean, they're the ones I know about, Damien, but others are obviously not doing so well, but I'd say Manchester's the one they mostly look to.
Okay, thank you. I won't go along the line because I'll keep you on your toes, and I'll come to you, Rachel. Manchester's unique status, how does it maintain it?
I suppose in terms of trying to find new ways to maintain that, it's looking at what the population that's moving into the city actually require, whether it's from an employment point of view, from a population point of view, and it's becoming very much a 24-hour, you know, there's a lot going on in the city, there's a lot of activity, and the demand for that means that it rolls out more and more. So that demand creates more demand, and therefore there's some people who see that the city centre could actually become an area which, you know, the offices are more and more pushed out. There's more population that moves in, and it just sort of maintains and rolls that demand for more and more and more, because we're seeing it, there's just more and more demand for more activity. And therefore, I think as long as it does, and how does it maintain, that status where people actually want to come here, and people want to come here from around the world. And you've said yourself that in terms of when you look at the statistics or different tables that are generated, from an international point of view, Manchester always is figuring all the time, and sometimes it's sort of ranking above London as a place to actually come to and want to be. So I think in terms of that demand, that status is creating more demand, and it's creating more demand for space, and I think that is how it keeps on going.
Okay, thank you. And Adam?
It's about understanding your strengths, first and foremost, but just as much as that, your weaknesses. I think a good few years back now, there was the Manchester Independent Economic Review, which told us what we were good at and what we were bad at. I think that's been refreshed as a GM-wide strategy now under the mayor. What I consider to be our USPs, or strengths certainly, are the airport. Surprise, surprise, I would say that. But we've got an international airport that serves 200 routes globally, direct now to China, to the west coast of the States, to Southeast Asia, to India. Not any other regional city has that on offer. It's the strength of the university, or universities, and the critical mass of students. And just as important as the students, if not more important, the research that goes on and how you harness that, leverage it back into the local economy. So the universities have a big role to play, and I think they can kick on to the next level and start being, you know, talked about in the global top 20. You've got a critical mass of NHS hospital trusts and the health population and density of population that comes with that. So we're a great test bed for life sciences, etc. as well. So it's playing to your strengths, but also understanding your weaknesses. I think the bit that's probably missing a bit for me is we've got a great higher education offer. I just wonder whether we are in charge of our own destiny enough around further education, secondary education. Are we skills matching to what our economy needs now and in the future? And that's where we could do more.
By phrasing it as a question, it sounds like you don't believe that's the case.
I think we can do more. I think there's too much competition in that market. I think we need to sort our internal competition out, decide what our strengths are, and start to work with the FE providers more so that everyone is complementary to the other rather than pulling talent in several different directions for the sake of a funding stream.
Okay, thank you. And Wayne, I'm sure there's going to be a consensus that there is a unique status that Manchester holds, but what are the risks to it? Adam's identified one there. Are there others?
I think, for me, I've been doing business in Manchester now for 15 years. One of the things that struck me when I first arrived in the city is I agree with all the points that have been made, but about the passion, the vision, the progressive attitude, the can-do approach of people. And I think the risk to the city is about making sure that we nurture that we identify where those individuals are, where those visionary people are, making sure that we continue to bring those kinds of people through. And I think the risk to us as a city is if we're not identifying those types of people. I think that would leave a big gap in terms of who those next visionary thinkers are coming through.
And again, you're phrasing it as a question, but it sounds more like a statement. The city isn't doing enough to recognise those visionary.
No, I think the city's done an absolutely tremendous job, and you know we all know who the visionary people are. But it's just maintaining that progression and that succession.
Okay, thank you. And James, broadening out slightly, the question here that what are we doing to address the inequalities between southern and northern Manchester through investment in towns such as Bolton, Bury and Blackburn? Is another risk concentrating too much on the city core and not trying to spread that investment and spread that prosperity?
Yeah, I think inevitably there's been significant investment in the core locations, and you know, that, whether that be from European investors, overseas money, North America, Asian money. 10 years ago, 80% of the big assets in the city were owned by UK institutions. The opposite is probably true now. I think it would be naive to think those type of investors are going to, you know, merrily go to Altrincham, let alone, say, Bolton, Blackburn or Bury. How do we encourage more investment in the north versus the south? I think we need to look at what drives economic growth. For me, that starts with people and skills. I read a statistic not too long ago that there are 10 times as many people with no skills in the north of Manchester than in the south of Manchester, which is terrifying. And unsurprisingly, businesses therefore are not as likely to grow or succeed in those locations. So people and skills, infrastructure, which I'm sure we'll talk about, but the ability to move around those areas is vital. And of course, availability of property and commercial property. And you know, there's been some successes in that regard. Blackburn, Maple Grove have been successful with Cathedral Square. We're going to move on to the second phase of that. So that's encouraging for that town. But you know, how do we do more of that? It's not just a property thing. It's a wider, a government policy thing around higher education and skills for me.
And for investment to reach all parts of the region, it needs to be public sector led, perhaps?
I think there are big regen projects that some of the UK institutions who are looking to invest in major regeneration, I mean sort of £300-400 million projects, they may look at schemes like that. But the likelihood of this global capital going to anywhere but the city centre, maybe the airport, Adam, that's exciting for them, I think is difficult.
Okay, thank you. And John, just to go back to that question about the unique status of Manchester, you're investing very heavily developing in East London. Manchester has a unique status, but a unique status isn't enough in and of itself to draw investment from an international investor.
I think it's a lot of consideration when you're investing into location. I think first of all, address the audience. We are Royal Albert Dock from London, not Liverpool. we choose London to invest at first. It is obviously it's a global centre. It has got a good infrastructure. All the tenants and business are located in there. Manchester, I call some of the panel in here, is you need to understand what is your strength down here. I can see that Manchester is growing on education. You've got the airport. You do have a lot of Chinese company now starting looking to Manchester. I believe this is two things is quite vital to Manchester in order to continue to attract this investor from abroad. First is, I think, is the confirmed support from the government in terms of infrastructure. HS2, HS3, if it didn't happen, I'm sure that will actually bring Manchester down a bit. And also working with public and partnership is important. With the right support from the government, local government, would able to attract a lot of private money. Our project in Royal Albert Dock in London is very similar, actually in some part, maybe even worse in part of Manchester. It was left empty since 1980, And the reason was is nobody dared to go into that area because there's no policy in terms of planning and there's no support and certainty for that area. And when we look into the project and we find that there are actually support, and also later the government turned that into an enterprise zone, which is the only enterprise zone in there. That is a kind of like cooperation, collaboration with the government as well. So we have some kind of certainty in there and leading us to commit to a project of 4.7 million square foot consented scheme, investing up to £1.9 billion investment into that area. It generates a lot of job and also create a lot of housing, a lot of business opportunity. And this is our the certainty sometimes we need to work with the governments, making sure there is a plan and the plan will come. And also master planning is very important. If we don't have a right master planning, we're not quite sure what you do, and the right master planning will have to fit into the locality of that. I'm not quite sure. Terry Farrow is one of the best master planner we have used, and they are pretty much the best in London.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to come back to some of the financials that would dictate whether you would come to somewhere like Manchester, but we'll come back to that. So I've got in front of a lot of audiences recently, and for many of them, they haven't wanted to talk about Brexit at all, but you're clearly not one of those audiences. So let's dive into Brexit and maybe get it out of the way, but we'll see if it comes back up. So do we feel Manchester is more or less insulated from the effects of Brexit than other areas of the country, especially, namely, London and the South East? Adam?
Big question. We're the second city of the UK, in my opinion.
Everyone else breathed a sigh of relief when I said Adam there, clearly.
We're the second city of the UK. We have an economy that's interlinked and forever probably dependent to a greater or lesser degree on London. We're not immune from Brexit. We're not immune from the impact Brexit could have on the city of London, the conurbation of London and the ripple effect north. We have a diverse economy now. We have an office market that isn't solely dependent on the public sector. We have tech businesses growing here all the time. Tech businesses, for instance, in the form of the Hook Group, are hopefully coming to Airport City in a big way, whose 70% of their revenue comes from outside the UK. So they actually, you know, if the pound tanks, their profits go up. So we need to find those businesses that can survive the Brexit turmoil and promote them and help them grow, because that's where I see resilience, really. It's probably the more traditional industries that are more susceptible. From an airport perspective, it's a bit of a worry, I have to say, for two reasons. The airport, Manchester Airport Group, owns three airports, Stansted, East Midlands, Manchester. Medium to long-term performance of those assets tracks GDP. So if GDP tanks because Brexit's bad, and people have less money in their pocket, they take fewer holidays. If they can pay for the flight, they spend less money on car parking, less money in restaurants, in the terminals, etc. That impacts Manchester, whether two of our airports are outside or not, because two-thirds of the dividends flow back to Manchester. There's then the stuff around free skies and whether there's going to be this seamless transition for aircraft to the continent or not. I think we'll get through that. We're not too worried about it, although, like a lot of Brexit, we're a bit concerned that green papers are only coming out now, rather than 2 years ago, but I'm sure there'll be resolution to that. And then final point is probably around Airport City, maybe a link to James, I don't know, around occupational demand. Most of our demand, certainly of scale at Airport City, is likely to be domestic UK demand. And if people get the jitters, are they going to commit to big office lettings or purchases? Personally, I'm not too concerned about the funding or the investment side of things. For everyone who get spooked and wants to exit the market, so on, I think we'll want to come in and see opportunity. But I am worried about occupational demand stalling in the short term.
And how do you prepare when things are so uncertain for March the 29th? Do you have multiple scenarios on the boardroom table?
Denial, mostly. they do. I think MAG, at one point, it veered to, you know, we are planning for a hard Brexit. I think they're now kind of medium to soft, probably a fudge in the short term. We've got a business now growing in the States, for instance, around airport lounges and car parking and hotels. So they're trying to diversify, but it takes time to enter a new market. I think we'll be okay. I think we'll be medium to soft.
And should we book a flight for March the 29th?
I think so. There might be some good deals out there.
Rachel, same question to you. Is Manchester and the area around Manchester more insulated than the southeast of England and London?
As a national developer, we talk to a lot of institutions about where they want to place their money. And interestingly, there are a number of parties we're talking to at the moment that do not want to come out of the southeast because the London, the southeast is, in their opinion, more protected than elsewhere. And that if you put your money in the south, you've got less chance of it being at risk. So from that perspective, Manchester is more at risk than London and the southeast. However, Manchester has got a very good economic base. As long as it can continue to get a good population supply, and work is the biggest issue that we are faced with around the country in terms of no matter where you, what sector you're developing in, wherever you go, population and labour supply is a major problem. And therefore, as long as Manchester can attract and have good housing, so from a population point of view, it's cheaper to come to Manchester than it is to go to London in the southeast. So it's got a good economic base and it just needs to keep attracting the population.
And what worries you most? Does anything worry you about that transition? Is it skills? Is it...
I think it is. It's making sure that we have got, across the whole labour market, it's not just skilled, it's unskilled labour that we've got. And, you know, the one big topic, do people want to talk about it or not? We need labour. So we're all talking about restricting labour supply into this country, and we really shouldn't be, because that can be a major problem for the growth of this country, whether you're in the south or in Manchester. So it is, it's labour supply across the whole board.
Okay, thank you. And James, to Adam's point about occupational demand, is that holding up?
At the risk of sounding like a super bullish agent, yes is the answer. I mean, we will have, remarkably, given the uncertainty around Brexit and everything that goes with it, we will have a record year of take-up once again in Manchester city centre. So, you know, that almost does not make sense, but anecdotally, I don't think we lost a deal last year as a consequence of the uncertainty with Brexit. So it keeps motoring on in spite of all this uncertainty. I think it would be naive to say, you know, there won't be a blip, there won't be a moment in time, there won't be businesses who stall and say, actually, wait, stop. I'm not sure what I'm going to do. I don't want to commit to that 10-year lease. But then, of course, that business needs to do something generally as a consequence of a property need. That then plays into another topic of debate at the moment, serviced offices, short-term leases, short-term licences, co-working, all those things that are very on trend. That type of demand plays exactly into the hands of those businesses, and those businesses are underpinning much of the take-up in Manchester. So it's an interesting scenario. We have loads of demand, supply at a relatively tolerable level. We need to be aware of what the uncertainties are, but we are not overly alarmed by it at this point in time. I think residentially is a different thing. I mean, Rick, no doubt, will have a view on that. But London and the South East, I think the answer to the question is we are less insulated. I think it'd be naive to think that we are going to be better off than London. The research within Savills points to the fact that, ironically, the people who will be most affected by Brexit are the people who voted for it. But in London, you know, in our residential business, where have we seen probably the most impact? Super prime, you know, £20 million plus housing. Uncertainty, you know, make sure some of those stick for a bit, those houses. So if anyone wants a £20 million house in London, now's the time.
John, as a Chinese investor who's been in the UK for quite a while, are you worried?
I think Brexit does bring across the board uncertainty. Doesn't matter you're in London, doesn't matter you're in Manchester. Obviously, London is still the driving force of the whole country, economic house. It affects London in terms of confidence, but on the long term, I don't believe that is the case. Let me give you some examples.
Sorry, John, I always mean to ask this question, I don't always, but what is the long term and what is the short term there? When does it become all right?
Long term, short term, in my vocabulary, in a way, is if you're buying a property as investment, it's long term. If you're leasing a property as 10 years, whatever, into the things. It's a shorter term. Now, Brexit may stop people going to enter and lease, but I can tell you just London transaction alone from China and Hong Kong for the first 6 months of this year is well over £3 billion. Now, it's benefit of obviously the pound is weak, but it actually show how outside market do have confidence in terms of UK getting out all right. It's just that at this moment in time, it's uncertainty. And this time is talking about it. And guys, in China, we're talking about a trade war. We don't even know Brexit exists.
That's a really good point. I mean, it is a localized issue, this. You know, people talk about it being the next global financial crisis. It's not even on the same page. This is a localized issue around the UK, and it's an opportunity for overseas investors because of the pricing of the pound. We had a meeting with some South Korean investors, and they said, if you want to see geographical risk, come and live in South Korea.
A first world problem, I heard someone describe it as at MIPIM. And Wayne?
It's a concern for us. What affects our clients will have a direct impact on us.
Are your clients concerned?
Our clients are concerned. They are concerned. They're concerned about tariffs. A lot of them are bringing over modular units for their high-rise schemes. A lot of it's being purchased from overseas. They're concerned about the impact that might have on some of these contracts that are sort of £40 million plus for that high-rise scheme. So there's a concern amongst our clients, absolutely. And as I say, what affects them will have a direct impact on us. We, like the others, we have contingency discussions and we try to make plans, but I think we have to be realistic in what we can actually do and what we have control over. And for us, that's keeping, two things we can do. Keep close to our clients, keep close to our people. Those are the two mainstays of our business. And that's our focus right now.
Okay, thank you. If anyone does want to come in or ask a question, raise your hand. If you're behind that pillar, you may have to lean over. But Rick, from a residential point of view, is it more troubling for that market, or does it point to the build-to-rent market, or is it a contributor to the build-to-rent market success?
I don't think it's got a massive impact on what we're doing right now. I mean, to answer the question, I think we're all in it together, possibly with the exception of people in Northern Ireland. But in our sector of build to rent, the mega trend is that we're not building enough houses. There's a housing shortage. The other trend is that more and more people are renting homes than owning homes. There is a shortage of affordable accommodation, which everyone knows about. And if you look at the housing market generally, I don't think it's a Brexit thing, but the unaffordability of it is very high. In London, it's probably something like 13 times the average income. Even in the regions, it's still kind of 8 or 9. So there might be some correction in the price of housing for sale. I'm not sure that's necessarily a Brexit thing. I just think that's a cycle thing. But to your question, does it impact what we do? There's a strong demand for rental housing. So companies like ours are doing our level best to try and meet that demand. And the equation for us is all about affordability, because when we look in a place like Manchester, for example, we have to look at the average earnings of people who live in the city centre, and it's about 26,000-27,000 a year. We can work out from that what sort of rent people will pay for their accommodation, and it's probably not more than 30% of what they earn. And we know what the cap rate is for the income that we generate, and we know what the yield on cost is that we're trying to get to. And that determines how much we can afford to pay for the land and the construction. And actually, I can tell you, it's a pretty tight equation. But I think when you're operating at scale, and we're trying very hard to operate at scale, we can make that work. And after that, it's really about how you formulate a proposition for residents that's really compelling. And it's about the house and the realm and the service that you put behind that. And I don't think Brexit changes the fact we've got a shortage. I don't think it changes the fact that people are moving back into city centres and wanting these sorts of options. And for the millennial audience that we predominantly cater for, We actually did a millennial living study, which I think you reported on, actually, Damien, not so long ago. And actually, that audience doesn't particularly want to buy. They think it's a bad investment because it's very expensive. They look at rental housing and say, actually, we can have a nicer home than if we bought. They look at it and say, we can actually live in a nicer location than if we bought. Our commuting time is lower than if we bought, and the commuting cost is lower than we bought, and we don't get slapped with a big bill when the boiler breaks or the roof needs repairing. So I think, you know, when you read a lot of the stuff, there's a lot of, you have to look at the data a bit more hard, and you've got to really research your audience. So I don't think it's a Brexit thing in our world, we just got to plow on. If there's one thing that we do, and I just thought about it when some of the other answers are coming through, if there's anything we do, we're borrowing for longer and cheaper. I mean, we're taking a much more longer-term view on our debt, I would think, is the one sort of insurance or hedge that we're taking.
Okay, a lot of nodding along the panel. So we're going into the some of the residential questions that have come in, and if Brexit isn't a meaningful factor in the conversations you have in the office, Rick, is this one, is the build-to-rent sector in Manchester city centre heading for oversupply and falling rents?
Okay, so when we first looked at Manchester, the first perception and reaction to that everybody has is, oh my goodness, there's a lot of schemes and a lot of units coming out. And it's true, there are. And if you look at the sector as a whole, beyond London, Manchester is way, way, way the most mature build-to-rent market. I mean, everyone else is at a fraction of the level of Manchester. But when we had the opportunity and we started looking at it, you look at the supply, of course, and you look at how much of that supply potential can really come through. And that causes you to look at, you know, can they actually fund it? Have they got planning permission? Can they execute? But actually, the more interesting thing to look at is the whole employment profile. Because if you look at the number of deals that you would be doing, and you look at the sort of companies...
It's not many.
if you look at the companies that are coming in, if you look at the profile of the people they're recruiting, if you look at the migration from the suburbs into the city centre, if you look at the number of people moving from London to Manchester, all of that would tell you that actually there's a very robust demand. So I don't think it took us long to get comfortable with the fact that whatever we did, we would find an audience for it. The second part of the question was, do we think there'd be a falling rents? I don't think so. I mean, for sure, at the margins and in the seasons, you might get some competition where people put in more incentives or they drop their rents to capture a bit more of the market share. But I think when you've got an environment where you've got very strong levels of employment, pretty low levels of unemployment, pretty low inflation, employment growth that's slightly more than inflation at the moment, and the sort of things that's going on in this city and the sort of vibe it's got, I don't think we're too worried about the rents falling.
Is that more of a consideration in other cities? Is that something that puts you off other cities?
It isn't really, because when you look at the data...
It's the same everywhere.
You know, the rents have all been going up higher than the rate of wage growth. So if anything, it's getting harder for residents to be in there. I think what might actually curtail some of the supply or the fears of oversupply is actually that the equation that you've got to hit, which I referred to a minute ago, if you're in an environment where building costs are actually going up faster than the level of rents, actually it gets tougher. And I think some people in places like Manchester, but it's not exclusively Manchester, where you're having to build taller and taller to try and make this work, I think that is tricky, because tall buildings cost a lot of money to build. I'm not sure they always create the best community and neighbourhood, which I think is another question. And I'm not sure you can just go and get more and more rent the more stories you go up, because it butts up against that thing of what do I earn and how much can I commit to the rent. And there's a fallacy, I think, that there's just this deep seam of people that are prepared to pay for five-star apartments and all the sort of high-end stuff, when actually, you know, for most of the audience, they earn typically 25 to 35, 40 grand a year, and that's what they can afford. And they might love to be on the 30th floor, but they won't pay any more than they would on the 15th.
Okay, there's lots of questions spinning off this, and Wayne, I'll put this one to you. Is Manchester City living exclusively the preserve of young professionals, or can it adapt to accommodate family living?
I know for a fact, as for one of the clients I do some work for, they are doing traditional residential accommodation, high-rise within the city, and they are targeting people in retirement. And what we are starting to see is more and more people in that sort of 55-plus age bracket coming back into the city. They obviously...
Is that after children rather than family living?
Yes, it is. But then you've got your, you know, that's a particular part of the market that that particular developer is targeting. But then you have others who are creating these neighbourhoods, creating schools within the PRS schemes to encourage exactly that kind of offering to that particular piece within the market. So I don't see that it's exclusively to preserve the young professionals. I think when I... Going back 15 years ago, when I moved into the city centre and I bought an apartment in Castlefield, that was very much the case. The offering, the proposition was very different back then. It was, you had an apartment block, you walked in, you closed your door and there was nothing going on. But now it's all about social experience within the PRS, and that lends itself much better to encouraging families to want to live in the city.
Okay, thank you. And Adam, how far can this go? A question that came through earlier. Can you ever see a time when city centre residential will have more owner-occupiers than renters, or vice versa, perhaps, more renters than owner-occupiers?
Well, it's a market I've not been in for a while, so correct me when I go wrong, but my gut feel is that the switch to rental over owner-occupation is probably here to stay, particularly when you combine PRS with the buy-to-let market. I know that's on a downward trend, but I think the capital values, if you're trying to appeal to that fresh out of university graduate into first professional job, the pay isn't there. Where are you going to get the money for the down payment, for the mortgage, etc., unless it's back to the mum and dad? And it's that recycling of monies through the generations. There's nothing wrong with renting. It's a lifestyle choice, isn't it? And it's a great lifestyle to have in the city centre, as I once enjoyed. And then it's a question of how far out do you go to sustain a family life. That's all about public transport infrastructure investment for me. I think the days of car-borne commuting back to the city centre for work, I wouldn't get stuck in a traffic jam for much longer. Cycling, I saw mentioned on the Q&A as well, has a big part to play, but we're not very good at it. I think Chris Boardman is trying to do the right thing, but we need to do more, and we need to get behind him and really reinforce those cycling routes, punching north and south through the city. Yeah, that's coming as well, isn't it? Yeah.
And James, another consequence, how do we ensure that we keep the current office and industrial building spaces when housing seems to be at the heart of the government's agenda?
I think to a certain extent that self-policing within the city centre. So, you know, we'll look at sites with developers, and many times you'll do the equation, and the answer is offices, because the yield profile, the rents in those markets will conclude that an office building is the right thing to build. I think what I think we'll see over the next 10 years is more mixed-use buildings in the city centre. So there aren't many examples of mixed-use buildings in Manchester city centre. It's very common in certain cities overseas, where you would have, you know, residential, hotel, offices. We haven't got many examples of that in the city. I think as land gets tighter, we'll see a bit more of that. There are some complications around tenure and ownership and management, but it works elsewhere. So I think we will see that. But I'm not overly concerned about the resi market squeezing the supply pipeline of offices. It hasn't to date. And as Rick says, you know, with construction inflation raging at 8-9% per annum, you know, these things have to stack up, and it's increasingly difficult for residential to stack up.
Okay, thank you. Time is marching on. There's still quite a lot to get through, but let's deal with this one quickly. Rachel, what makes great placemaking?
I suppose the basics are infrastructure, which are buildings, your communications, but then you've got to add on a great population as well, and then public realm, which sort of brings it all together to try to make a place that people actually want to spend time, whether that's sort of working, living or entertaining. So very difficult to say. In terms of trying to pick an example, years ago, when I first started to work in Manchester, I was involved with Hume City Challenge. And that was where the crescents were demolished, and we had to create a new sense of place for the people who lived in Hume and Moss Side. And we took we sort of created park areas, we created nice residential areas, we used the markets as a sort of a centre to try to, you know, place make. Has that been successful? I suppose that's out for the audience to sort of say that, but what we tried to create...
What's your view?
I think we were successful because we took away some really awful residential areas. We created a nice residential space. The only issue I would... It's not just about residential space. We created a nice area, whether it was for working, living, etc., for the people who lived in that. I'd say the only problem is coming back to population. You can't change the population. So if the population change is the same, you can create a nice place, but unless the population actually really want to make the most of that place, and most of the people do, but if you don't change the population across the board, it's very difficult. So there's all sorts of things you can do from a regeneration point of view, but you can't always necessarily regenerate a population.
Sounds like gentrification,
maybe.
If that's your goal. John, what makes great placemaking?
Making more money. Good placemaking, obviously, a good investment. But what makes it great, most important is when you have a large-scale regeneration scheme, when people don't know about it, placemaking is really, really, really important, especially at the beginning to the mid-phase of the delivery of the project. Because nobody really know what is the project vision end game is, and what it is placemaking allow the community able to understand what we are doing down there. For the business, they understand what opportunity are down there. And a good placemaking, I can actually make some example. For example, as simple as just say broadcast booth outside BBC when they regenerate the whole area. It actually attracts so many interest in their business in there. That is actually a big selling point for the Way City project. King's Cross is very successful in terms of their placemaking. It used to be, everybody would actually been to King's Cross 20 years ago and they understand what I'm talking about. But through the placemaking, even before the building coming up, they can actually see what is the place to be. It is important that developer is not just about building the buildings. Developer is about building a lifestyle. And through placemaking, we can convey the message we are what we are delivering to the community and to our customer or our occupier. And that's why I think that is what makes great.
So there was a reaction from the audience when you answered that question, slightly flippantly, I think. Sure. But do you have to sacrifice some of your returns to make a great place, or can returns be maximised and placemaking be maximised?
No, you don't do lose business to start with. Yeah. Every pound we spend create placemaking, we're going to get more than £1 back in terms of value. That's for sure, I can assure you, unless you're not doing correct. And also, placemaking is you always face out. So there's a location or different location create different kind of activity to attract people to come into the location or to the project at the beginning or the mid phase. Those port will eventually get built out, or those port is originally in the master plan as the public room area. So it doesn't actually eat into our profit at all, but it actually generates more value.
Okay, Rick, you didn't look like you agreed with everything John said.
Look, in our job, placemaking's the most fun. It's the bit that really gets you excited, gets you up in the morning. And it is central, absolutely axiomatic to our proposition for residents. If the place is kind of dead, people won't come. And so, you know, the answer to the question is, sure, you have to design your master plan and your buildings to create a great place. But placemaking is really, in the end, made by people. I mean, we all kid ourselves about placemaking, but actually all we provide is the stage for it to happen. But, you know, a lot of our team at the Olympic Park at East Village and down at Elephant are engaged in making this happen. And we find we have to kind of invest in it and stimulate it to start with. But there's a point of inflection when actually the people who live there do their own placemaking, and you can just sit back and just watch it happen. But we do stuff all the time. So, you know, over the summer, we had a big TV screen that had the whole World Cup. I mean, the local authority told us we had to put fencing around it. There were so many people coming into it. The retail stuff that we do attracts people, and we don't let to any multiples. They're all to sort of local, independent-owned traders. We've got barbecues going on all night, every night. There are outdoor gyms. There's stuff going on there the whole time.
And does that require an acceptance that you will get lower profits over a scheme's life,
no,
or at least
more.
In the short... Well, is it lower in the short term, but more over the
no,
life?
No, I wouldn't even say that, because, you know, when you start something, sure, you invest in it, but the minute you invest in it and make the place, your absorption rate goes up. I think if you don't invest in that, you're actually just killing yourself. So I would say it's completely symbiotic with the whole business plan. You invest in it, you get the revenue back. And it is the most fun. It's the best bit of the job.
I think it's going back to a conversation about, oh, this is the community, or this is the market, and this is it. I think that is looking at very setback approach. Placemaking is about complete clean sheet of paper on the location or on project. You create your own demand. You put in things that will come up with the demands. For example, our project, it was an empty dock. 100 years ago, it was busy, but it left them empty. Now, today, everybody can talk about high-tech innovations. And before that, we don't have any technology potential. Nobody know that we're doing techs. Placemaking, we create tech weeks, we create Porsche car coming in to showcase all these things. Now, suddenly, we got a lot of tech companies interested in the location. Now, this is about creation of the market. It is not about organically sitting down and say, well, this is what I got, what I'm going to do about it. It's a creation. Placemaking allow you to create an extra market, an extra commercial dimension.
Okay, thank you. We could turn this into a whole hour on placemaking, but there's more things to get through. Let's go to infrastructure. I will come back to these other two questions at the very end, so get thinking about solutions. But someone with a very good memory asked, last year concerns were raised over infrastructure to Manchester City Centre. 12 months have passed and it has got worse. What are the proposals to improve the infrastructure to and from Manchester, James?
I think we were talking about this on the way down, actually. I think I've sat on panels like this and said over the last 4 or 5 years that, you know, we pat ourselves on the back that we've got a Metrolink system and it's been extended and we can get around Greater Manchester on that and the infrastructure here is great and it's better than Birmingham. But actually, you know, someone asked me, how do I get to work? I get a train each day and it takes an hour to do 30 miles and 60% of the time I get a seat and I'm quite happy about that. There seems to be an acceptance that, you know, mediocrity within sort of public transport infrastructure is acceptable in this country. And I don't know why that is. I
mean, and the transport infrastructure in Manchester is mediocre?
Well, I think if you went to some international cities in the Far East, you would come back and say, at best, it's mediocre. I think we are ahead of many of our competitors within the UK, but and I'm not suggesting the council do this or Transport for Manchester, but you know, we can't be complacent with regard to any forms of infrastructure, and not just public transport. You know, connectivity, IT connectivity, is especially important. So I think it's a absolutely critical thing to ensure that we attract employment to the city centre. You know, 5 years ago, big businesses centralised into Manchester city centre. The majority of take-up was by businesses that weren't already here, and they did that because they saw investment in infrastructure, and we've got to keep doing that. If we don't do that, other cities will go past us.
Okay. Do you have a solution in mind? Do you have a preferred solution?
Do I have a preferred solution? That's a difficult question. Extension
a better
of
train links, line for you.
You know, I mean, we don't have a blank check. We've got to be realistic that, you know, budgetary constraints mean that not everybody in this room is going to be able to walk to a Metrolink station. But, you know, why is it the case that, you know, I pay £15 to travel 30 miles on a train, and you know, 2 days of the week it's cancelled, and 60% of the time I can't sit down. I mean, it's just ridiculous, and people will, I'm sure, agree. It was a fiasco over the summer. I felt really sorry for people who had to put up with that service, and how you deal with it. I think if I knew the answer to that, I wouldn't be sat here. I'd be doing something much more clever.
You'd be sat here as Transport Minister, presumably.
Add to that.
Wayne.
I think we all recognise it's a horror getting in and out of the city, but I drive in from the south each day, and it's just horrendous. And it's not an answer to the problem, but I think there's, again, going back to what I was saying at the start of this talk about people thinking a bit differently, a bit more innovatively, and people thinking about, do they really need people in the workplace 5 days a week? Do they need people commuting into the city, commuting in the office, into the office? Or is there a different way of using technology to allow people to work in different locations so that they don't have to be in the city? And that's something that we as a business, we've looked at, we've embraced that through agile working. And you know, the consequence of that is we've got people who are all over the place, but not necessarily in the city. So I think there's another way to look at that, a different perspective.
Okay, Adam, you mentioned cycling. How important are Chris Boardman's B-lines proposals?
I think it's vitally important to James's point around Metrolink not being able to touch every chimney pot. You know, if every arterial route is gridlocked, bike is a great alternative. We live in a rainy city, but I was at Mipham last year. The Danes do it, and their climate is a lot worse than ours. We just need to prioritise. That's not easy. It costs money, but I think he's trying to do the right thing, albeit against a backdrop of underinvestment for years. If I might just comment while I've got the microphone around, outside of the city centre and to the airport. So just for context, it would take HS2 and the whole of Northern Powerhouse Rail to give us the same public transport catchment that Heathrow and Gatwick already have. So that's just a standstill. So it's not just about the city centre, it's about the whole of the northern region being fed to Manchester Airport in a way that isn't car-borne. That might impact our business ultimately. We have a big car parking business, as you would expect. But if we're to grow from 28 million passengers to 35 to 55, as is our potential, we need some very, very meaty public transport investment.
So there's a real economic cost to your business and plenty of
productivity throughout the north, yeah.
Okay.
I suspect the problems there are actually great for the likes of Rick, because increasingly millennials will say we don't want to live outside the city centre because we don't want to commute for 45 minutes, an hour a day, and we would much rather live in the city centre.
Rick, you're nodding there. That's
yeah, for sure.
Top of your list.
Bring on the bikes.
Okay. And Rachel, I think underscoring the question, last year concerns were raised, 12 months have passed and it has got worse. Is it getting worse rather than standing still, that provision? Transport infrastructure provision in and around the city actually getting worse rather than standing
provision,
still?
Provision, it wasn't, I think, if I'm not incorrect, Manchester was recently put top of the list for congestion in the UK in terms of most congested city to get into. So I mean, it must be getting worse. What's that?
Worse than London.
Apparently. So I suppose, I mean, in terms of, I can't really comment over the last 12 months, really. What I would say is, if I can. Again, I was working in Manchester 29 years ago and I was attracted to Didsbury because I was told that Didsbury was going to have a metro link, a transport link, which would go from Didsbury to the city centre. So I thought, right, I'll go to Didsbury, buy a flat. And I think it was opened a number of years ago, so it's just woefully very poor. So I think as the population's growing and people are more attracted to Manchester, it's probably got worse, and I think it's just going to get better. But just picking up on a theme, it's interesting that some of the office areas outside of Manchester where people previously didn't necessarily want to go to, because the links are getting better, the office take-up is increasing outside of the city in terms of office areas are getting better and out to the airport. And it's interestingly that the Hook Group chose to go to Manchester Airport for their new offices as opposed to coming into the city, and they've got a very young population and they're very happy to have that out of the city. So it'll be interesting to see whether, if there's more of a squeeze in terms of residential property, people wanting to be in the city centre, and I think Manchester becoming very much a 24-hour city where there's lots of activity, that because of the poor infrastructure, people then do push out, and more office occupiers, some office occupiers do actually go out of the city.
Okay, thank you. Just before I get to one last, we've only got a few minutes left, one last enormous catch-all question, so brace yourselves for that. I'd just like to ask John to throw a hand grenade into the audience. We were talking beforehand about some of the things that would encourage you to come here. We've talked about those on the panel. But we touched on some of the things that would have to happen for someone like ABP to come here. And what's the financial criteria that would enable someone like ABP to invest in Manchester?
You're asking what kind of profit margin I want to make.
You can be as open as you like about the figures.
First, ABP, we only do and look at large-scale scheme. So anything, minimum scheme we would look at is 5 million square foot. I mean, largest scheme we look at is about 180 million square foot. So this is the things that will suit our appetite. I can summarise some of the question about infrastructure and about all that. It is all important to anybody wanting to invest into Manchester as well. We do large scale for one good reason, because we can design and re-engineer the whole area, and which is make things much economic, efficient, and also lifestyle is much easier. Everybody now, they probably prefer to have, especially the younger generation, prefer for urban lifestyle. But then if you look at in Hong Kong, if you look at in the Tokyo and those cities, they pretty much just build a whole infrastructure around it so that, you know, your shop is just downstairs, your friend just next door, your work probably just two blocks down. You never need to even think about tram traffic and all that. London, Manchester and UK, we love our history, we keep our legacy and all that kind of thing, but in some way, it could actually stop things progressing. I come to Manchester this afternoon. I mean, I tell you, I'm very impressed. I'm able to come here within 2 hours. It took me longer from my office to Heathrow. So what traffic? I think traffic is good, but on the other hand, it's regeneration, if you want something that you want to have everything, right? I don't want traffic. I want to have able to work close to my home and my friend. I'm able to enjoy my life around here in one location. There's no choice but start from the ground up again. And these are the kind of things that will make us look at a location. Do we have the opportunity to start from ground up? Because otherwise, there's no value for us to invest into those things. It would be just going to the same.
But you'd also look at rental levels, and are the rental levels in Manchester high enough?
Actually, it's very surprising the rental level is as high as almost same as what our development at the moment marketing as £35. So, yes, I can see there's actually demand, but I also probably able to see why there's a lack of stock in certain office buildings.
Okay, thank you. To that last big question, so what's the next big thing for Manchester and what's the biggest risk? Next big thing, if any of you think it's digital, that would be good. We haven't touched on that. If any of you think the one of the breaks on the city's growth reputationally or in terms of returns is the very conspicuous homelessness problems and you have a solution, please do put that forward. James, next big thing and the biggest risk.
Yeah, I think the next big thing, I think retail. I mean, retail is a very, very challenging sector at the moment. So why is it the next big thing? I think it's the repurposing of retail premises, probably less so in the city centre, but in more periphery locations where high streets, secondary shopping centres will continue to ail, and there'll be a repurposing of that to other uses. A research colleague of mine has copyrighted the expression retail dential this week, which is very sad of him, but the principle of change of use in secondary shopping centres to include some element of residential, which to me sounds a very good idea. Biggest risk, I think, is around USPs. USPs has always been skills, I mentioned that before, but also affordability. You know, we can't price ourselves out of the market. I think we're fine at the moment. We remain price-wise competitive versus Greater London. Birmingham, though, Birmingham is catching up at a rate of knots, and we're being told this by investor and occupier clients. The attraction of people moving away from Greater London to somewhere that is an hour away is a big thing. You know, Manchester, for many people, is a bit too far away from family and friends, and Birmingham are doing quite well in attracting those type of people who are skillful and, you know, bring businesses with them.
Okay, thank you. John?
Manchester is heavily dependent on the HS1, HS2, because that is actually the artery of all the possibility. I mean, at the moment, you've got a lot of students. I've been told it's probably about 100,000 students studying in Manchester. The problem is those students would leave Manchester when they finish their graduation. And how are you going to be able to retain them? You've got to create a market, and a market based on, well, it's infrastructure. No business will come up, set up their headquarters while there's no link to London to start with. And I think also another big thing about Manchester is the logistic as well. We are talking about drone and robotic, those kind of things. I can actually see maybe Manchester have some of those things. Creating that USP, I think, at the beginning of this panel is talking about what is good about Manchester. I think Manchester, as far as I know, is a logistic hub for the whole UK, could actually bring into that. Another good thing is I can see is more and more Chinese company coming to Manchester, set up their logistic warehouse, start doing trade directly to retail sector. I can see that also coming, because that is again linking to the logistic nature of Manchester. But this is a good thing, and this could be something, could be big.
Okay, thank you. And Wayne, briefly, a next big thing and a big risk?
I think next big thing, we've got world sort of class sort of knowledge leadership on life sciences and tech, and I'm particularly excited about the prospect of a collaboration between the two. I think that'll be something very unique in this region. In terms of risks, I think not getting the infrastructure and the transport right. It's like, I sound like a broken record, and it's been heavily debated, but it's such an issue. I really do think that's it just has to get sorted out one way or another.
Okay, thank you. Rick?
I'll tell you what I'd like to see to be the next big thing, and that was, I mentioned it 2 seconds ago, is that the whole scooter thing. If you look what's going on in some of the American cities, and I think it's going on in Madrid, the whole Bird, Lime, you know, you rent your electric scooter thing. I think, A, that could address some of your intra-city transportation things. It's playful, and that talks to the whole sort of Manchester proposition of being really cool. Unlike a bike, you don't have to get changed. Unlike a bike, you don't get sweaty, so you can sort of still go to your next meeting. It doesn't occupy very much road space. And I think if the first city that takes this on, and it looks pretty obvious to me, would really get another sort of huge recognition. I'd love to see it in this city, and I think you've got the capacity to do it.
Okay, I think it's high on Uber's agenda, isn't it? Rachel?
As a result of Brexit, there's going to be a whole raft of government departments that are going to be sort of being pushed out. There's new departments being created, and there's a lot of work going on in central government looking at how the regions can benefit from those departments moving out of. And I think Manchester is extremely well placed, whether it's in the city centre or on the edges, to actually benefit from those departments coming out. The risk associated with that is making sure that we've got the correct skill base to be able to keep those offices going, but good opportunity.
Thanks. And Adam?
Selfishly, I think it's probably the opening of our £1 billion new terminal in the next couple of years. I think it's, and I say that not just because it's a great project, but it's direct routes to Mumbai and Bangkok and Shanghai that follow. We've released data recently, the China dividend, the direct route to Beijing, exports up 200%, tourism up 300%. And these are big numbers that start to shift the needle and give you some resilience and put you out there in the growth markets of the world. I think more locally, it's the tech and digital economy that's really quite exciting to me. I don't know if James has any further comments about the city centre, but my experience out at Airport City with the Hook Group, just think of the scale they're talking about. That's 10,000 jobs 5 years ago, and still they're on a business park in Northwich. It's unbelievable growth. For context, the Co-op headquarters and the CIS tower in town, there's probably 4,000 people in there. Took the Co-op 150 years to get there. It's just phenomenal. It's with risk, of course, not specific to the Hook Group, but that sector. For every Hook Group, there'll be 100 failures, but we've got to find those nuggets out there and support them and promote them and help them really have a step change for our economy.
OK, James's views will have to wait till the bar on that, I'm afraid, or we'll get lynched. A really broad range of topics. Thank you to our panel. Thank you to all our partners tonight. And thank you for your questions and for coming. Thank you.